How long have we been friends?
We're not friends. I don't even like you.
You do.
They love the world. They don't want it destroyed. So they start working to save the world while all of the forces of heaven and hell want to end the world.
Times are changing.
Files, a podcast where two Americans talk about British pop culture. I'm Sheldon.
I'm Danny.
And I am excited we're trying two mics today.
Yeah.
New setup.
Yeah, it's a new audio setup. I think it's going to sound much better.
Yeah, hopefully you guys like it. It sounds good. It seems clearer.
We are no longer sharing a mic.
No.
So, you know, we feel a little more important.
We're still sitting in the exact same positions, though, which is nice.
Yeah, let's get into this week's episode. Let's start off with news, because I've been really liking the news segment that
we've been doing.
So, and I apologize, I will be clearing my throat a lot. My throat does not feel good.
Because, as she told me right before we started, she sang too much Pat Benatar on the way home, and she's burned out her vocal cords.
I was singing in the car for about 45 minutes, and I shouldn't do that on a day that we're recording, but, you know, we live and we learn, so...
Yeah.
All right, so, this week in British news, one thing I wanted to talk about was, it was actually last week, Michael Palin, famous for being one of the members of Monty Python,
yes,
was knighted.
Now he is Sir Michael Palin.
He is Sir Michael Palin. So I kind of looked into it because the news was cool. I shared it on our Anglophiles Facebook page, but I decided to kind of, like, read a couple articles and just, like, I don't know, get some more info. And, it turns out he was knighted last week at Buckingham Palace for outstanding achievements, personal bravery, and services to the UK and British overseas territories.
Personal bravery?
Yeah. It seems that he was knighted for his work as a travel host and writer, as opposed to his work in Monty Python, which I thought was interesting, because, yeah, he does a couple of travel shows and does a lot of really cool stuff, like documentary stuff, so.
Maybe the Queen's not into Monty Python, and he really, like, had to prove himself to her.
Well,
oh,
speaking of, I found out, in looking into this, that apparently John Cleese was offered to be knighted, not recently, but at some point. He was apparently offered the honor of knighthood, and he refused.
Wow, so I wonder why. So she's spurned. She's like, you gotta, now that I couldn't have him, you gotta really prove yourself.
It's true.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I wonder what that's about. Yeah, so, but good for Michael Palin, because that's great. He's been doing a lot of really good stuff as a travel host.
And yeah, and that's an honor.
He seems like a really cool guy.
It's an amazing honor that Americans will never receive.
Yeah, we don't know anything about knights here in the U.S.
You can get an honorary title, though, right? Like, you can't be a knight, but you can be something else?
I have no idea.
We'll have to look into it. I'll look into it. Or if our British listeners, if you know what the term is, because I think there is an honorary term. I don't know if it's an honorary knight or if there's another separate term, but please let us know. I have a story.
Ooh, I had one last thing. So did you hear the big joke that a lot of people were making about Michael Palin being knighted?
No.
He is now officially a knight who says, "Nee."
That's pretty great.
Which is a really good Monty Python joke. Yeah, I guess when he was being knighted, they interviewed him and he said, "I've played a knight before." I guess he played multiple knights in, what is it called?
Monty Python
and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
So I forgot. I almost called it Spamalot, but that's the musical.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the news. So what was yours?
That's pretty great. Mine is fun. I love this. This is something that would never happen in America, which makes me love it even more. So the UK has installed a new traffic sign, or they're about to start rolling one out.
Mm.
Can you guess what would be on this traffic sign that they're just now, like, we gotta warn people about this
thing? A traffic sign.
Yeah.
So a sign that they put in, by the street?
Yeah, it's a sign that would be by a street denoting something.
Hedgehog Crossing.
That's literally exactly it.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It, so basically there's going to be a new traffic sign. It's a triangle and it is, it's a little red triangle here. Oh, do you see that?
My gosh, I was joking.
Yeah, but basically it's warning motorists of hazards involving any small animals.
That's the sign?
That's literally the sign.
Oh my gosh, it's, we are going to post a picture of this on our Instagram.
Yeah, it's a red sign with, it's a red triangle with a white triangle inside and this cute little hedgehog.
That sign doesn't look like an official traffic sign. It looks like something that somebody made in Microsoft Paint.
I think this is just the concept. It's getting rolled out soon. But apparently the big problem is that they're seeing a massive decline in small wildlife numbers, especially hedgehogs.
Mm.
Hedgehog population has halved since the year 2000. And it's really sad. So,
why?
Because cars.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, because wildlife can't survive with cities. And so basically they want to help. It's reducing the number of wildlife, but also they think it'll reduce the number of people killed or injured as well. Because once you see that, you'll realize like, oh, okay, yeah, pay attention. Like, I think it's going to benefit everyone in the UK.
Wow, I was just joking about that. I had always heard that hedgehogs were kind of like in America, we always have like possums smashed on the roads. And if you're in Texas, armadillos. And I had always heard that hedgehogs were kind of the English equivalent of that. That they're just kind of all over the roads.
Except they're at least cute.
Like, hedgehogs are really cute. But possums are cute.
Nope. They are not. They are demons.
No.
You have never lived in the woods and had to go and had to go and feed your dogs and scoop your hand down in where your dog's feet is and felt fur and had a possum hiss at you.
Okay, no, I have not.
They are terrifying, mean creatures. Mm. They are so gross. They've got all sorts of weird, wrong fur. I don't like them.
I think they're...
And then my dad always used to say armadillos are possums that are prepared for war.
That's true. Yeah, like, they can just have armor.
Yeah, they do have some armor.
What else? Oh, we have emails.
Oh my goodness, so this is amazing.
We have some listener mail. We've had multiple people email us on our anglophilespodcast@gmail.com. Email... Here's the thing. When we first started this podcast, we started to put out episodes. I made our email, and I was so excited to get listener mail, and no one really was emailing us, and I was like, oh, okay, well, that's fine, whatever, you know, it's not why we do this.
Exactly.
And then at some point, my phone disconnected the email, and so...
So you just weren't getting
I just wasn't
any
receiving
updates.
any notifications that there were any emails.
Yeah.
And for some reason, my phone just decided to withhold them all for me. So I logged in this week to just, like, I don't know what I was doing. And I was like, oh, it made me re-enter my password. I found, like, 4 or 5 emails from people.
We've got them now.
Some as far back as 4 months ago. So if you emailed us... we just now received them. I think I've replied.
Thank you so much. We read them all now. They're delightful
thank
emails.
Thank you so much for emailing us. We love hearing from anybody who wants to talk to us.
Yeah.
So,
and on our Facebook messages, too, we know several people have sent us those, and we interact with people on Facebook.
But, yeah, if you emailed us a long time ago, we apologize. We're getting it all. We're getting to it all now.
So do you want to read one?
Yes. I thought we would read one. We got an email. I think we'll probably eventually read all of them.
Yeah, just like one every episode until we read them all.
I mean, we'll run out of them real quick because we didn't get that many, but...
Oh, but we're going to keep getting them. I'm banking. We have a great audience. You're going to keep sending them in.
Maybe my mom will send one.
Oh, please, Diane.
Diane, you know where to find us.
The audience wants to hear the words of Diane. We can read them out
I don't know
loud.
About that.
I think so.
But,
we mention her like every other episode.
So
she's an enigma.
This is an email from Paul Stevenson. The subject of the email is The Great British Conveyor Belt of Comedy. So, already a good sign that this is going to be a good email.
Yeah.
So, Paul says, Danny/Sheldon, first off, I love your Anglophiles podcast. As a Brit who lives in another country, Denmark, I'm always interested to know how our humor comes across to others, and especially if our particular brand of sarcasm and understatement is transferable. One of my favorite things to do is watch American reaction videos to British comedy shows on YouTube.
Mm.
In one of the episodes, you talked about how Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie were introduced to one another by Emma Thompson at university. But I was wondering if you realize that almost all British comedians were also alumni of the same school.
Whoa.
The Cambridge University Dramatic Club, known as Footlights, has produced an astronomical plethora of comedic talent since its founding in 1883. I think this plays into something you said about British actors coming from the upper echelons of society and it being quite difficult for working class actors to break into the industry because of the lack of connections. And then here, Paul inserted the link to the Wikipedia article that lists all the famous former Footlights members.
Yeah.
This is something we'll probably read on a later episode because there's a lot of...
Maybe we have a whole episode just about Footlights. That would be interesting.
We honestly could. There's a lot of people in there. And then he continues, I haven't heard you mention it, but I would love for you guys to do an episode of Only Fools and Horses. It's a classic British comedy with David Jason and Nicholas Lyndhurst set in South London in the 80s. The main character, Del Trotter, is a Cockney wide boy, a London slang term
a
for
wide boy?
Yeah.
It's a wide boy?
I am about to explain it to you, Sheldon. The main character, Del Trotter, is a Cockney wide boy, a London slang term for shady character who deals in illicit goods, who constantly wants to improve his position in life and climb the social class structure. He sees himself as a typical 80s yuppie, but in reality, he's just a common South London market trader. Unlike most British comedies, this show ran for about 10 years and is constantly ranked as one of the most beloved British shows. And then he included a link to a clip from Only Fools and Horses, which I played for you, which had a really funny little bit of slapstick
physical comedy
that is very good. And that clip alone was a... We laughed very hard. Yeah. So I think we really need to watch Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah, because he's not the only person who suggested this. Multiple people have suggested we've got to watch Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of suggestions.
So I think that's one of the next shows we do.
Anyway, Paul says, keep up the good work, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
So I responded. I said, hey, thanks for your email. Do you mind if we read it? And then he sent a follow-up email, which I'm also going to read because it's interesting. He said, Danny, of course you can share my email. Before I read your reply, I was listening to your snack episode on my way to work.
Yeah.
Random fact, all the big British chocolate companies were actually founded by Quakers. Cadbury, Roundtree, and Fry's were all started by very religious Quakers who thought that chocolate would be a good way to get British people to stop drinking alcohol. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. Paul.
It's amazing that, like, so much of our food has been created in order to stop us from doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's great, if we're plugging another podcast, there's a great episode of The Dollop where they talk about how breakfast cereal was created to get people to stop masturbating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
Yep. It is just very interesting.
But thank you, Paul, for sending in this email. We really appreciate it.
We learned a lot.
And it's fascinating to know, like, he's a Brit that now lives in another country. Mm-hmm. So, like, he also has a very unique perspective on his country.
It's true. Yeah. But, yeah, we love this email. It was great.
Do you want to dive in?
We will in a second. Yeah, just if anyone wants to send us an email, you can send it to anglophilespodcast@gmail.com. That is files with an F. Yeah, we look forward to reading some more.
Yeah.
So, yeah, do you want to talk about Good Omens?
I would love to.
That is our topic for today, Good Omens. We are going to talk a bit about the book, and then we are also to talk about the Amazon original show.
Yeah, which is the main reason why we did this episode right now, is because a show just dropped on Amazon, Good Omens.
If
you've read the book but didn't know that the show came out, it's on Amazon right now, the entire show. You can binge it. It's a fast watch.
Let's talk about it.
So the book.
Yeah, what did you know about the book before you read it?
Well, nothing. You just told me to read it. You read it first and you were like, you've got to read this.
Yeah.
And I know, like, I had read a little bit of Neil Gaiman, or at least know of his stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Terry Pratchett. Like, so this is a book I knew that was co-written.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's written by two authors at the same time, which I feel like very rarely you get success out of that. Like, it's hard to do something like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of... you don't read a lot of books that are, like, fiction, novels that are collaborative works.
Yeah.
So
I think sometimes you get, like, husband-wife duos, but I think it's rare to get two friends like this.
Yeah, so I remember I've read a lot of Neil Gaiman, actually. It's not something I ever intended to do. I think I just, like, kept, like, finding more things by him, and I was like...
What have you read of his?
I've read Neverwhere, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, What else is there? American Gods.
Yeah. His most famous ones, other than those, are like The Sandman, Stardust, yeah. Coraline, Graveyard Book.
I did read Stardust.
Yeah.
And it's very good.
Also a good adaptation. The movie's pretty good, too.
Yeah, Stardust is fun.
Underrated movie.
But yeah, so I was always a fan of Neil Gaiman. I always really liked his stuff. And so I remember, I definitely read Good Omens before I had read any other Terry Pratchett.
I see, yeah.
Because I read Good Omens and then was immediately in love with it.
Yeah.
I remember when I read American Gods by Neil Gaiman thinking, like, oh, this is my favorite book. This is my favorite book of all time. And yeah. I was like, nothing is ever going to really top this for me.
Because it is an incredibly unique book.
And then I read Good Omens and I was just like,
never mind.
Because American Gods, well, I love it. It takes place in America, which is cool. Yeah. But yeah, Good Omens just manages to put like even more fantasy elements into it. And it's set in England. It ticks all my boxes.
And it has Terry Pratchett's sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Neil Gaiman brings about, he is incredibly smart when it comes to fantasy. And he can create concepts that other people wouldn't even dare to dream.
Yeah.
But Terry Pratchett is so great at injecting humor in his writing. Like, you can read different voices. He's very clever. And I think we should correct ourselves. We've already mentioned Sir Michael Palin. It is Sir Terry Pratchett.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. But, I mean, we don't have to keep calling him that. But, it's a shame that he didn't live to see this television adaptation, because I think he would be pretty pleased with it.
I think so.
And Neil Gaiman apparently really pushed to get it made and wanted to see it through, mainly for Terry.
Yeah.
Like, there was an interview where he said he wanted to make sure it happened because Terry and he both knew that it could be something big. And once, like, everyone really kept coming to him to have him, like, sign the book and everything, he knew, I've got to see this through. I've got to make sure that this is as good as we created it to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really cool. Terry Pratchett is kind of like a legendary fantasy author.
Yeah. Mainly because of the Discworld series.
The Discworld series.
Which has, I think, 41 books in it.
I have been, like, hearing about his stuff ever since I was a teenager, and all my friends have read it, it seems. And the only thing I have read by Terry Pratchett is Good Omens, and then Mort. I've read Mort. I read that on our honeymoon.
Yeah, you did.
And it's very good. Very, very good.
On our honeymoon, I read Mistborn, which is not good, by either of them.
Yeah, but it's a good fantasy work.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, let's talk about the show. I think
I would love to.
We need to start off by talking about the cast, because
oh my god.
Here was the cool thing for me about reading, when I read Good Omens. So when I decided to sit down and read it, it was when it had been announced that it was going to be a show.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, I always like to read the book before these things.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I better get this done. So by the time I sat down to read it, David Tennant and Michael Sheen had both been cast and announced. So yeah. David Tennant had been announced as the Demon Crowley, and Michael Sheen had been cast as Aziraphale. So when I sat down to read Good Omens, I was reading it with both of them in my mind.
Yeah.
And it really, really made it really magical to read because, I don't know, it was just so perfect.
Yeah, I think they do a phenomenal job. I don't know if I 100% pictured them when I was reading it, because I also read it after it had been cast, but I don't think, like, whenever I read it, it was its own new thing. It was all completely, I read these, the blank slate characters are so funny and so full of life, but it's nothing compared to what David Tennant and Michael Sheen bring to the role. Like, they have such great chemistry on screen.
They do.
I
think it's hard for anyone not to have great chemistry with David Tennant.
Yeah.
Because just everyone he acts in a scene with is just, yeah, it's just wonderful. So,
it's true.
Yeah, it makes sense. And then Michael Sheen is an incredible character actor. Has some of the best performances.
I mean, if a guy can go from, like, massive franchises like Twilight and Tron,
mm-hmm.
and then do television appearances on 30 Rock. I mean, he shows up all over the place, and anytime he's
Masters of Sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he was very good in that.
He is one of the most underrated actors of our time. Like, the guy can do anything.
He's pretty great.
Like, and he injects comedy into everything where it's like, oh, this isn't a comedic role. It will be.
Like Twilight?
Yeah, his like character Twilight. And the same with Tron, where he should just be this creepy, like, club owner.
I think he's the best part of Tron.
He's the best part of that, Tron.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Michael Sheen. So they're fantastic. I think it was also really smart for them to do the show with narration.
They had
because,
to. Yeah.
Like, I really loved this show. I thought it was really great. But I think that the book is better, just as a complete
The books are usually better than the television or film adaptations.
The book is, like, I think one of the greatest fantasy books I've ever read. Whereas the show, absolutely love it. But I don't know, like, that it's, you know, one of the best shows ever made.
I mean, it's so hard. Like, I know, like you said, you pictured the two of them in that role.
Yeah.
However, you still probably pictured everything else in the book happening. And so whenever you watch something after you've already made your mind see it vividly and it's ingrained in your soul, where you're like, I know what the ending of this book looks like. And then when they show up, you're just like, that's not my ending, but this is good. I mean, it's that kind of a feeling where you're like, this is good, but it's not how good it was in my head.
Yeah.
Because the book is so good.
I think it was really smart for them to do narration because, I mean, the characters and story are great, but some of the best parts of the book are just, you know, the narration of the book, the comedy and the commentary on the in the book. So,
in the footnotes.
Having the narration by Frances McDormand was great.
Yeah, Frances McDormand basically playing God.
Yeah. It was really good.
A smart choice.
Who else?
John Hamm as Angel Gabriel.
He was amazing.
And when he was cast, we were both confused because Gabriel's not really a big part of the book at all.
I think he kind of comes out at the end.
Yeah, I think he's there a little, but...
But yeah, it sounded like they kind of like expanded his role.
Yeah.
So that was good.
I love how all of the angels were pretty incompetent. Like, they were all just so blinded by the fact that they're like, but we're the good guys.
But we're the angels.
We win. This is the battle. This is what it's all for. It's leading up to this.
Yeah, that was cool. Jack Whitehall as Newt was amazing. I remember after I read the book was when everyone else was cast. And so as each separate person was being announced that they were cast, I was losing my mind because Jack Whitehall as Newt was so good.
Yeah, that is inspired casting.
He's so
and
funny.
If anybody hasn't seen it, there's a great series on Netflix called Jack Whitehall's Travels with My Father, where he goes around and travels the world with one of like the fanciest, most stuffy old men.
His dad.
And his dad's like a lot older than he is, so it's really pleasant. That's a fun series. If you like Jack Whitehall in this, please give that a watch.
It's interesting. I think he was very good in this because Jack Whitehall, in person and like in his show and when he's on like QI and stuff, like he's just a very brash, very confident, maybe overly confident young man.
Yeah.
And he's pretty cool and like thinks he's cool because he is.
He thinks he's cool. I wouldn't say he's cool.
I mean, I get that, but you know, he's cool. He's like hip. And so I thought the casting for Newt was pretty perfect, but I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. And he was so good. He was so good at playing like awkward and quiet and shy. And it really surprised me in a pleasant way.
Yeah, I think so.
Michael McKean was in it as the Witchfinder General.
Sergeant Shadwell.
Michael McKean is incredible in this.
I love him.
And it's interesting, he's American, right?
I believe so. I think he's not British, at least.
He was playing...
Yeah, he's definitely an American.
Yeah. Well, he was fantastic.
Yeah, and the accent he puts on, because he's got like a thick... Is it Scottish?
It sounded Scottish.
Yeah, I sometimes have trouble telling Scottish and Irish apart.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, depending on the area.
And depending on the time period, because, like, both accents kind of change depending on how far back it is.
Mm.
But there are a couple of other great actors and actresses in this, like Miranda Richardson.
Oh, I love her. We talked about her a lot on our Blackadder episode.
Yeah.
Because she's incredible.
She's so good in that. And then Adria Jorna.
Adria Arjona.
Arjona. I cannot say it. I saw it spelled out and I thought I knew it.
I had to do a lot of research on her once for a project. And
she is so beautiful.
She is gorgeous. But it's a very natural beauty.
Yeah.
Like everything that I've seen her in, like a TV and movie, she doesn't have a ton of makeup on. She's just very, very naturally beautiful. And she's also a pretty great actress.
Yeah, she's really great, and she's good as Anathema Device.
Yeah, I was excited because when I read Good Omens, Anathema was one of my favorite female characters in a while. Yeah. I think she's so cool. She's just this cool young witch who's like following in the footsteps of her ancestors. She's a professional descendant.
And she's not like, you would never say she's incompetent the way that the other angels are.
Yeah, yeah.
But because of the way that these prophecies are laid out, she doesn't fully understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And she's doing the best she can. Mm-hmm. And I think we can all kind of identify with that as people who are now, like, you and I both on the cusp of being like, we're fully adults. That's what we have to be.
We have no idea what we're doing.
And you kind of see that in her where it's like, she's confident for the most part. She 95% knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
But 5% doesn't. And that, like, humanizes her so much more than a lot of other characters in film and TV or scripture and books that
literature
that seem like, oh, they're perfect, where she has these little like moments where she doesn't completely know what she's doing.
Yeah,
and that's great. I think it's really well done.
She's a good character. I thought she was fantastic, and then she and Jack Whitehall were really good.
Yeah,
together. So
other than that, there's so many other great actors and actresses in
there.
This.
Were some great cameos. Mark Gatiss.
Nick Offerman,
yeah.
There's
a lot of good names.
Brian Cox
is dead. Yeah, he never really showed up so much as he lent his voice.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, this is like a star-studded cast.
Was there anything from the book that you weren't sure was going to make it in and you're really glad made it into the show?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the book, because I don't think we've touched on yet what this is. Like,
true.
If people don't know what Good Omens is, basically, it is a story about the apocalypse. And the two lead characters, Crowley and Aziraphale, are a demon and angel, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them, over the course of history, have become close friends.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think they're hesitant to call each other friends for a while.
Yeah.
And then they realize, you're the closest thing I have to a friend, because the people in hell don't like me anymore, and the people in heaven don't like me anymore. And so...
And what I think is really interesting is just the fact that when Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden, you know, that's where the book opens, is Aziraphale, who's like the angel that's supposed to be protecting the entrance with a flaming sword, is watching them leave. He gave his sword to them because he felt so bad because Eve was pregnant and they were just going off into the wilderness by themselves. And then Crowley slithers up as a snake. He's the snake from the original Garden of Eden.
He's the reason why they got kicked out.
That they're not just an angel and a demon. They were like one of the first
angels.
They're the
angels. OGs.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. And it's funny how, like, I think that their characters kind of... You know, we have these ideas about, like, what is good and what is evil. And, like, in a lot of movies and books, there are characters that are just so noble and good and characters that are so evil, when in real life, most people are not one or the other.
Life isn't black and white.
Yeah.
Like, we live in the gray.
Yeah.
And this book revels in the gray
of
people knowing that just because I am on the side of good and I have a mission, that doesn't mean that the things I'm assigned to do are what's best for everyone.
Yeah.
It may be what's best for my side.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's best for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they care more about humans than any of the other angels and demons. The rest of the angels and demons care about where they're from and the big battle that's supposed to happen.
And winning.
And
they're
winning.
All about winning. They're not really looking for, like, what can we do to, like, make sure everything is good? They just want to win. They want the battle to happen. So, yeah, I think that they care about humans. I think they also just really like Earth. I mean, and humans are a big part of Earth. But I think they like, you know, living in the city and, like, driving cars.
Eating food
and reading books. Like, they've become so attached to Earth that just... Oh God, the premise of this book is so good. They're so attached to Earth and the lifestyle that they've been leading for centuries that, yeah, when the apocalypse is about to happen, they're like...
They don't want to give it up.
Maybe we make it not happen.
Yeah. And they're, like, the only ones in the entire universe who are trying to stop it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other than an anathema device.
That's true.
But I think going back to your question, my favorite part of the book that I desperately wanted to make it in, I love Crowley's car. Like anything in the book mentioning his car, his Bentley, how attached he is to it, the fact that in time, any cassette that's in there gradually turns into a cassette of Queen.
Yeah. Like Queen's greatest hits.
Queen's greatest hits will always play.
What's not to love about that?
Yeah. And I think my absolute favorite scene in the book is whenever he has to get to this airport. He's got to get there.
Mm.
And basically the thing in between him and the airport is a massive wall of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And he drives through it like something thousands of degrees hot.
Yeah.
And his car catches on fire. And it's sheer will that keeps it going, that because in his head, he knows the car is fine and he knows the car can get him through.
Yeah.
Like he wills it there, and seeing it visually, it was perfect. Like watching the car literally on fire and the second he gets out, it falling apart because it was a miracle that it got there. And miracles are a big part of this whole show.
It's true.
But that was my favorite scene come to light, that I'm like, good. I'm glad that that was realized the way I saw it in my head.
That's
good. It was my favorite, like, little detail. But what about you? What was your favorite scene in the book that made it to the show?
I don't know if there was a scene in particular, because pretty much most of the book, unless I'm forgetting some things, it seemed like most of everything made it in.
Yeah,
I know that
for the most part.
I saw some people talking online about things that didn't, but...
But, and then that was just, like, subtle changes rather than they left big things out.
I do really like... I wasn't expecting them to keep the Queen soundtrack. Sometimes you read a book, especially something from the 90s, that's mentioning a specific artist or music, and it doesn't always make it in, but...
And
so
because
that I thought was really cool. They got the rights.
An artist like Queen, is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Like, those rights to that music, and to only use Queen, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, that had to be very expensive for them.
Was really glad that they did a lot of flashbacks to throughout history. Things from the book that I loved that I wasn't sure was going to make it in. Like, they showed Agnes Nutter. They showed her...
That was cool.
...sitting in her cabin. Basically, she knew that they were, like, a mob was going to come and burn her at the stake. And she just was like, you're late.
Yeah, because Agnes Nutter she's actually mentioned in the title of the book, not in the show. The show's just called Good Omens, but the actual book is titled Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch.
Mm.
That's like the whole title of the book.
Yeah.
So from the start, you're like, oh, who is this Agnes Nutter? What is she? And she's not in the book hardly at all. Because it's about her legacy, that it's this woman who predicted everything, but not accurately.
No.
I mean, yes, very accurately, but she didn't always tell you the details. You don't need to know them, but...
Just vague sentences that just happened to arrive. There was one moment in the book that I loved so much that wasn't really in the show. Like, the scene was in the show, but this little moment didn't happen, and I was a little sad about it. And it was when Newt is driving his car and the, a UFO just comes down right next to his car and he's not shocked or flabbergasted or like struck. He's just like, oh, and like the aliens pull him over essentially. And they're like, sir, are you aware that your planet has violated this, like some pollution code or something? And he just goes, oh dear.
Yeah.
Like, such an understatement to the situation.
Like, oh,
and just,
Earth.
Yeah, and I just pictured Newt just sitting there with his hands on his steering wheel, looking at the aliens, just very, like, sheepishly, just being like, oh dear. And they're like, all right, well, make sure you tell somebody, and then they leave. So the alien scene did happen, but...
Yeah, and who played the aliens? I forget. There's somebody.
I don't remember.
It was a good voice. It was somebody I recognized, but I don't remember now off the top of my head.
We'll have to look it up. One thing that I didn't realize while reading the book that I only realized when I was watching the show was all of the weird stuff that was popping up, like the aliens, like the Kraken coming out of the ocean. I didn't realize that was all Adam making it happen with his dreams. For some reason, while I was reading it, I thought it was just all end of the world stuff. Like the world was ending, aliens are coming down and checking it out, or like... Krakens are rising from the deepest part of the ocean. Like, I didn't realize... I guess I didn't connect that Adam was making all of that stuff happen because
he is
the Antichrist.
Literally the Antichrist.
Yeah.
Very interesting, too, to have the Antichrist be, like, a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like, I think usually whenever you hear or see it depicted, you think of the Antichrist as, like, a grown man.
I definitely think of a little boy because of The Omen.
Oh.
Have you seen The Omen?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about a little boy who's the Antichrist. Like, they even make a little reference to it when they get the Antichrist and the mom's like, I don't know what I'm going to name him. And the nuns are like, Damon is a good name.
Yeah, Damien.
So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. But one thing I do really like about that is the fact that the Antichrist and some other random baby get switched. And so the people
that
who
scene
are...
That was brilliant.
It was really well done. But the people who are supposed to be raising the Antichrist to be this great, perfect Antichrist who's going to help bring about the apocalypse, all they have is a normal kid.
Yeah.
And then the kid who actually is the Antichrist just gets raised by normal parents. Who have no idea.
Hey, no clue.
Again, with the whole, like, what is good, what is evil, you know? Like, I think that really plays into it as well, where it's like, well, is he the Antichrist because he truly is evil, or are you just, like, making him that way?
Yeah.
So the fact that Adam basically didn't really grow up to be evil.
And it's funny how, like, basically, they were trying, Aziraphale and Crowley, trying their whole life... of this, the wrong kid, just a random, normal human. Both of them were, like, throwing in evil and very good things just to even him out.
I did.
Because that was their compromise.
I love that scene where, what is Aziraphale's playing, like, the gardener.
Yeah.
And
he's
teaching
got these,
him,
like,
you know, be nice to all the creatures of the earth. You know, they deserve your kindness. And then Crowley is, like, the nanny who's, like... Nope, they're all meant to be under your foot.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, it was, that was very good.
So good. All of the different, like, costumes and hair and makeup that David Tennant had on in this show were amazing.
David Tennant loved this role. You could tell just the way he was walking, kind of snake-like.
Oh my god. And speaking of, I think one of the best scenes in the entire show is the scene where Crowley is trying to intimidate his houseplants into growing better. He, like, walks in and all the plants immediately start shaking. And he starts berating them very harshly. And he points to one that has, like, a spot on its leaf. And he's like, look at this! And I love that scene so much because it's shot as though it is just this very, very terrible, horrific scene. But it's just him talking to his plants.
Yeah.
And it's so good. And it demonstrates, like, oh, this is evil. But it's it's like the most chill form of evil ever.
Yeah.
So I love it so much.
I liked it a lot. Was there anything that you didn't love from, like, book to screen? Because I have one thing. Like, we mentioned him before. I did not like Brian Cox's death, and I did not like how death looked at all.
I didn't care for the design once the, like, motorcycle helmet opened and you saw his face. I didn't...
It was cartoonish.
Yeah, like, it just didn't seem as ominous.
Especially when the other three were super ominous.
Yeah.
Like, the rest... The famine, and they replaced...
Yeah.
Pestilence got replaced with Pollution. Yeah. She's the new Pestilence. And,
but it was weird. They had war, they had death, but then the devil showed up. So, like, it kind of, like, undercut the effectiveness of having death personified if Satan's just gonna show up and be, like, the way more powerful one.
I guess so. The horsemen are not as strong as Satan, though.
It's true.
I mean, the horsemen, in my mind, are the harbingers of the apocalypse. They're the ones who bring it about.
Yeah.
And Satan's the one who's like, thank you for serving me. You did this for me.
Mm.
I imagine they're like other demons, like level entities like that.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Sheldon!
We gotta cut all that out.
Never! I think it's time for a little break. I think it's time for a snack break.
I think so.
Quick! Into the Bentley!
There's a prophecy.
Alright, welcome to snack time. This is the part of the podcast where Sheldon and I like to try a British snack that we've never tried before.
Okay, my favorite part of the night.
It is your favorite part.
Most of the time.
We try a lot of candies. We try a lot of other things. Today, we are trying a candy bar called Drifter.
Drifter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's neat. It's a blue wrapper with this bright red and white Drifter text on the front.
Have you ever had this before?
I haven't. I've literally never heard of this. I don't know if in England Drifter has any different connotation than it does in America, because it Americans, like, a drifter is kind of more negative, right? Like, it's somebody who...
Like a transient?
Yeah. And so it's interesting that it's called Drifter. I wonder what it means.
We probably should have looked it up. Yeah. But yeah, it says crisp wafer dipped in chewy caramel and covered in milk chocolate.
Sounds like it's right up my alley.
Sounds like a Boost bar. All right, let's try it. I think
it sounds more like a Twix.
Why don't you...
And it kind of, like, now that we look at it...
But it's wafer, kind of like a Kit Kat? I don't know. Why don't you take a bite?
Let's see.
It does kind of look a little bit like a Twix, but with more chocolate that's been, ribboned onto it. Okay, what is your reaction?
There's a lot going on in here.
Okay.
Both texture-wise and flavor-wise. I'm a big fan, I think. The wafer with chocolate around it and then caramel inside is such a very unique taste. Like, it's amazing that the wafer is still crispy. That I think in a lot of other cookies that have, like, a wafer type thing inside, it gets a little soggy.
Really?
It's not as crunchy and crisp as this.
Like a Kit Kat?
Yeah, like, I think a Kit Kat is more solid.
I just took a bite. This is amazing.
This is very good.
It reminds me a little bit of a Boost in that it's got the chewy caramel, it's got some crunch, and then it's covered in chocolate. I think the Boost tastes better both in flavor and in texture, but I am super into this.
I think the Boost had a lot of stuff going on inside of it. Like, it was mostly, the inside was mostly gooey. This is not mostly gooey. This is mostly crunchy. That's why I don't think it's like a Boost at all.
Okay.
That's what I would say. Is like,
it's got the same ingredients.
But I think it's like, this is only like 2% caramel, whereas Boost was like 80% whatever that liquid goo is.
Chocolate?
No, the chocolate's on the outside. The inside of a Boost was mostly liquid. Like, it was that...
It was like a soft chocolate.
It was like a nougat or something. Like a... But I don't think this tastes like that at all. I think this is its own beast. I don't think we've had anything with, like, a wafer like this inside of it. We've had other things that have cookie taste in it, like a biscuit, and it doesn't taste like a biscuit. Like, it very much is this thin, crisp wafer.
I like it, but it's... I don't know if it's because it's Nestle chocolate or what, but it is making me so thirsty.
Oh.
Voila.
Get a sip of your tea.
Oh.
It reminds me a little bit of... I can't think of it now. Oh, a Tim Tam.
Okay.
It's kind of like a Tim Tam. Like, not as...
A little bit.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I would say it's closer to a Tim Tam than a Boost.
I think we both have very different ideas about this candy bar.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Are we eating the same thing?
Do you like this? Do you like the Drifter?
Yeah, I mean, it's high up there for me.
Okay.
It's not my favorite that we've tried, but
would you buy it again?
Probably. Like, I do like this. Mm. I like candy bars like this that come in two separate little things next to each other, where they're like, here, like, yeah, have one small thing and then save the rest for later. Or if you're feeling real randy, eat them both.
Randy?
Yeah.
Do you know what that
randy
means?
Randy for chocolate. Chocolate Randy. Chocolate Randy.
I don't know about all that. Well, that was an interesting snack time. It was kind of brief. But hey, we're here for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really want to get back to it and
it's
talk
true.
About this episode
all right,
more.
Let's head back into our Tacket. Let's go! And we're back. What else about Good Omens the show did you want to talk about?
I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the demons that are, like, hunting down Crowley and the way he, like, outsmarts them. And we haven't talked about the demons at all and how creepy and gross they were.
One of the best parts of the book is when those two demons come to Crowley's flat.
Yeah, and he home alones them.
And he's ready for them. He he puts holy water in a bucket above the door.
Like he's a 5-year-old pranking his older brother.
And then I can't remember. I think he pretended that he put holy water in the plant, mister.
Yeah.
And then held it. And what was really cool in the book is that he goes, like, he waits for them, and then he goes and he sits at his desk and puts his feet on the desk and, like, leans back in his chair and he just holds the plant, mister, and just waits for them.
Just ready.
And, yeah, I think it was just too dangerous for him to actually put holy water in the plant, mister.
He didn't want
to
risk it.
But, yeah, because it would just burn him and kill him. And so that part in the book was so cool. Because, yeah, they walk in, one of them gets hit with the holy water, dies.
Oh, instantly melted.
The other one is like, he's like, I've got a plant, mister, full of holy water. You better leave me alone. And the guy's like, I think you're bluffing. And he can't tell. And at first, I think he thinks it might actually be holy water, but then he sees, like, one little drop land on Crowley's hand and nothing happens. And he's like,
immediately.
I got you! And then Crowley picks up his telephone.
Calls his own answering machine.
Travels into the telephone. Yeah, calls his own answering machine, travels down the telephone line, almost like that scene in Gremlins 2.
Yep.
When the electricity gremlin goes through the phone. But yeah, goes through the phone, goes into his answering machine. And then the other guy follows, the other demon follows him into the phone, into the answering machine, and then Crowley jumps out, and then the guy is stuck in his answering machine and is the message, just yelling at Crowley.
And it's even funnier in the show where the only other answering machine message is from an angel basically telling Crowley, like, I know how we can stop the apocalypse. I know where the Antichrist is. And so this demon is literally in his own hell, finding out that one of his other demon friends is working with an angel to stop the apocalypse. Yeah. And they're the only two people that know where the Antichrist is.
It's so good. I was really glad scene. That they gave, like, some good time to that scene from the book, because it's so good.
I loved the character design, how disgusting all of those demons were.
The demons were nasty.
The, like, each of them had a weird creature on their head.
Yeah, like a frog or a
frog
lizard.
Or a big lizard. Ooh. And they just kept getting bigger, and I don't know why they got bigger,
but
I liked it.
They were so gross and dirty. Yeah. But then again, the angels weren't that much better. Like, they were clean.
I was going to say, it was all
white
up there.
But that's all they really had going for them.
They were mean.
They had weird, and, like, did you notice that the angels each had, like, gold on them, but in different places? Like, some people had gold teeth. Some of them had, like, gold on their lips or, like, on their face.
On their clothing.
It was really weird. Like, they were bad, too. It was very interesting.
Yeah. But, yeah. And Gabriel had purple eyes.
Yeah.
John Hamm can pull off those purple eyes.
What did you think about the design of Heaven and Hell?
I liked it. I liked that Heaven was just this big, broad, open, white room. And Hell was just this, like, dingy little cramped space
basement.
Water was dripping down there. It just seemed, like, kind of grimy.
Yeah.
It was nice where, like, neither of them was great. You know, like, neither of them would be ideal to live in forever. And
true.
So the fact that these,
they preferred Earth,
immortal creatures are living there forever.
Yeah.
You get why the two rebels decided Earth is way better, because
it is.
It is.
I think that one of the best episodes was the episode that basically just, like, showed them throughout time.
Their friendship developing.
Yeah.
Yeah. How, like, that one was so good.
They met, you know, I mean, they, of course, were, like, knew each other during the whole, like, Garden of Eden thing, but then they, like, were meeting throughout different areas of time, and then, like, the Inquisition happened, and Aziraphale thought Crowley had, like, made the Inquisition happen, but he hadn't. It just happened on its own. But he was like,
"Oh, humans do that."
Yeah, it was really interesting.
And then that episode was also great. I love any TV show that takes the risk where they say, "We want to do a cold open, but let's do, like, a 20-minute long cold open, and then play the title."
That was the episode where, like, 20 minutes passed, and we were like, ooh, we're full on into the episode, and then the title sequence came on.
And we were both just stopped and looked at each other like,
what is happening right now?
None of that was the episode
That
yet.
Is what's so cool about streaming television versus
like
traditional TV.
Yeah.
They can play with that format.
Yeah. Yeah, because if that came out week to week and that was just happening, you'd be a bit confused if you just came upon the show.
It's true.
In the first couple minutes.
What do you think about the title sequence?
At first, I was like, okay, this is weird. And then very quickly, I was like, oh, this is Monty Python weird.
See, like, you say Monty Python, but it reminds me of Hieronymus Bosch.
I don't know what that is.
I showed you those paintings. Has all these weird depictions of hell where, like, all these crazy creatures are flying around and eating people and people... It's crazy, but that's what the opening scene reminds me of. It's, like, all these, like, angels and demons and, like, people slowly walking towards this cliff. Kind of like everyone is slowly heading towards the end of the world and they don't even know it.
It reminded me a lot of, like... the kind of British animation from, like, the 60s and 70s. It where, is, like, the Beatles did a lot of this kind of stuff.
Monty Python in that kind of, like, it's like paper stop motion.
Yeah, it's a little stop motion. It's a little, like, slapstick over the top. Mm-hmm. I think it very accurately depicted the show. And you just see all of these creatures, all of these people just marching together.
Yeah.
And the whole title sequence, are just marching, marching, marching. And then you see them all jump off a cliff. And they either fly to heaven or fall to hell.
That was the best part, is that every person that jumped off, they either get little wings and fly upwards, or they just keep falling.
Yeah.
It's so dark. Funny.
And great.
But I do like the music. It's kind of simple, but it's very effective. This little, like...
little jaunty.
Little marching jaunty tune. And what I did also like is at the end of every episode, they play the same song, but played with different instruments.
Yeah.
So, like, there was, like, a violin version and a piano version and... it was just so good. I think that this show showed such great reverence to the source material in a way, to a degree that a lot of other things do not.
Well, I mean, I think it helped that Neil Gaiman was the executive producer and was on set for everything.
It's true.
Like, I think you need that to happen.
Maybe like a year or so, maybe like 9 months until the show actually premiered, Neil Gaiman tweeted a picture of himself on set holding the flaming sword. And I almost lost my mind.
Yeah.
Because I love this book so much. It's so good.
Did you spot Neil Gaiman in the show?
No. I had heard that he had a cameo.
In the fourth episode where David Tennant is in the cinema, the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Neil Gaiman as all of the other people in there. He cameos as... the other people that are in there, just in different parts of the cinema.
What?
Yeah.
I need to watch the show again.
And also, something I thought was a good nod, I didn't know this until I read up on it a little bit, but in Aziraphale's bookshop, they brought Terry Pratchett's hat and scarf that he, like, always
that he was
wore.
Known for.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look up pictures of him, there's always him wearing this hat.
Yep, and a little scarf. Aww. And that's in Aziraphale's bookshop. I thought that's a really good nod. One that they didn't have to do. It doesn't add anything to the show, but I think it underlines, like you said, the reverence for the source material, for the authors.
But you know there were Terry Pratchett fans who saw that immediately.
And yeah, and had to lose their mind, like, yes, thank you for that.
Apparently there's like a foreword at the beginning of the book, the copy that I have of Good Omens, where Neil Gaiman kind of gives this foreword where he talks about, like, this is maybe of anything he's ever written, this is like one of the most revered by fans. And it's one of the things that when he and Terry Pratchett would do signings, they would like appear together and you could bring your copy and they would sign it for you. And it's one of those books that like people would bring... copies that were like barely held together.
So
because they were
red.
Like tattered, they had fallen in the bathtub, they had food on them. There was a guy who like the binding had come undone and his book was like in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
Because the pages, like, it was the only way to keep them contained.
But I get that too. As somebody who like has kept the same set of Harry Potter books since I like initially bought them, like they've gone with me through multiple moves, multiple cities. Like once you get something you really have an attachment to that you reread that same book again and again, every time you read it, you're remembering the other times that you read it.
It's true.
And that book holds so much importance, and I get why it holds a spot for everyone that reads this.
It's such a good book. It's such a special book.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, like, I mean, I've only read one other Terry Pratchett book, so I don't know, you know, what do I know? But I read Mort, and I really loved it. It's an amazing book. And I really love a lot of Neil Gaiman's works, but, like, something really magical happened when they made this one together.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's, I don't want to say it's better than any works from either one of them, because that's an opinion, but it's so good.
But it's elevated to a way that it needs to be held apart from any of their other works separately.
Yeah, that's true. It is, yeah, it's special. So good. Yeah.
Well, before we get done kind of like wrapping up, just talking about it, I realized we haven't talked about the very end, the very, like, last episode, when the apocalypse is literally happening. They have failed to stop it so far. Everything is going to happen. Like, Adam has his clan of, his little gang of friends called the Them.
The Them.
And Anathema and, I can't remember, Jack Newt. Whitehall's, and Newt are, like, racing towards there. Everything is happening. It's all coming to a head. And then Satan shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And he's voiced by
Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But apparently they insisted upon him. Like, he was somebody that they knew from the beginning. They're like, we have to have Benedict Cumberbatch as Satan.
Interesting.
Which, weird, I guess, because he's barely in it. Like, he doesn't
do
a lot.
You can't even really... Like, if I didn't know that that was him voicing him, I probably wouldn't have guessed it.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. He probably came in and recorded for, like, an hour and then left.
I bet so. Yeah, because he definitely didn't do the body
he
movement
for
it. He wasn't
over
the stop motion.
Day.
Yeah, no way. Well, how British do you think this story is? I know we asked that a lot.
So, it's interesting, because this was a show that I wasn't even sure that we should do on this podcast, just because... Everything else we do on here is a British show that airs in Britain on British television.
Except and we did do Game of Thrones.
It's true. That was a little different. You're right. But this, I think, falls in line with Game of Thrones in that it has so many British actors in it. It also takes place, like, in and around London.
I think,
while it's not... It's not the traditional thing that we usually do on this podcast. I think Good Omens as a story and as a show and a book is extremely British.
I was going to say, I would disagree. I think this is one of the most British things we've ever done.
No, I agree.
But that's what I'm saying. But you were saying it, like, comparing it to Game of Thrones, where to me, I'm like, no, this is, like, British authors writing a story about Britain,
mm-hmm.
about, like, the humor of Britain, starring a British cast. Like, everything about this screams England. There is nothing American about this
Michael
show.
Michael Sheen, I mean, Aziraphale's character... Just the fact that he's like, I'm gonna read books and drink tea. Like,
yeah.
He's very British.
And the fact that, like, I don't know, Crowley, if you had a demon in America and American people were gonna make this show, he would be much more, like, intimidating and muscular, I think.
Mm.
Like, they would cast, I don't know, it would be, like, a big spooky guy.
Yeah.
Instead of this, like, sexy slim man that we got in David Tennant. I love... The choices of casting that they made, like, everything from start to finish feels like it's only taking place in England. It can be nowhere else.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's extremely British.
Yeah.
One thing I also wanted to talk about really quickly was the scene when they're in the church in London during the Blitz.
Oh, yeah.
And Crowley,
so sad.
I think Aziraphale, like, saves them from getting blown up, or, like, Crowley saves them from getting...
They realize they can't use a miracle to save their own life.
Yeah.
But they can casually use a miracle to just happen to save their friend, who they don't want to admit is their friend. They can use a miracle and just be like, I'm saving everyone in this area.
Yeah.
Oh, you're there too? Well, I happen to save you.
And that's one thing that... The book definitely had this, but I think the show really hit on it even more, was that the story is kind of ultimately about friendship.
Yeah.
And it's really sweet.
And in every level. Like, I think it's about partnership. It's about finding that person that you're like, yeah, we can go through this together.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a clan of children who you're like, yeah, together we can make each other strong. Or it's like a man and a woman falling in love in the middle of a storm, like, underneath a bed. Or it's, like, an old man and, like, an old woman falling in love,
aww,
despite the fact that they should not be together one bit. But it's about coming together, putting aside differences, and understanding that your differences are what make you connect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people that are exactly like you aren't going to challenge you, aren't going to push you. People who are different from you can make you a better person.
That's true, yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that's very much the theme of this book.
It's so cute. I just loved how much they, like, were there. They were there for each other. Yeah, it was good. Anyway, why do you think somebody should watch this? If they haven't seen Good Omens or they haven't read the book, what would you tell them?
I would say it is the most unique take on the end of the world you'll ever see.
It's true.
It is only a tiny bit sacrilegious. So if you like things that kind of toe the line, that are like a little tongue-in-cheek in what they are, that I think it depends on you having a base level of knowledge of Christianity or the end of the world, kind of knowing what the tales have been.
Yeah.
But it's delightful. It's a fun, goofy, smart show that's incredibly well acted. I think, like, it's a fantastical way to show the world ending and mm-hmm. why it shouldn't.
I think it is amazing that it's about the end of the world, which is traditionally always very heavy subject matter.
Yeah.
But it manages to be one of the most fun.
It's light.
It is light.
Yeah.
I was trying to tell someone, like, the subject matter is more serious than American Gods, but it's funnier and more light. It's interesting.
American Gods is kind of about the end of the world, too.
Yeah,
in a way.
A big war. I also would say, if you like Douglas Adams and you like Hitchhiker's Guide.
Douglas Adams.
It is very, very similar to Douglas Adams in tone.
Yeah.
So, that's
all. Is there anything else we didn't touch on?
I mean, we could talk about, there's not enough time to talk about.
Yeah, I know, we didn't talk enough about Agnes's prophecies and how they work and how they just pluck a random one and it would fit.
I love it.
There's so much we could have gone into. Them we barely covered. The way that they got weapons at the end.
Ooh, here's something people can reach out to us. If you want to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook or our email, let us know which cast member you think did the best job with their character.
Yeah.
I would like to know what everyone thinks.
Yeah, and I would also like to know who you would have cast as Death.
If not Brian Cox.
If not Brian Cox, who would you have cast? What is the voice of Death?
That's a good question.
I would like to know.
Are you ready for your word?
Oh, I always forget that it's coming, and now I'm so excited.
Every episode, I make Sheldon guess a British word, whether it's a slang word or a word for a dish or something like that, a Cockney rhyming slang.
In every episode, I get it correct.
I think you've only gotten two correct, so.
Well, I agree to disagree.
All right, your word is Starkers.
Starkers?
What do you think Starkers means?
I think I know what this one is, actually.
What is it?
I think it's like, you're crazy. Like, stark raving mad. You're Starkers.
Use it in a sentence.
Like, oh, you're jumping in that pool with all your clothes on. You're Starkers, mate.
I love when you use it in a sentence. Because you're always wrong and it's really funny. So, incorrect.
What?
Nope, it's not. It doesn't mean.
This was one of the times I was certain that I knew it.
I could tell. Starkers is slang for naked.
Oh, stark naked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you got drunk and you were running around Starkers, you were naked.
Huh.
Naked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there another? Well, I'm.
Yeah, but like.
I feel like I've heard of it to describe a crazy person before.
I mean, possibly. It might be. Possibly.
But
I mean,
wow. So it's naked. If you're naked, you're Starkers.
All of the British words that I get for you to guess, I'm getting it all from online. And I think mostly they're very reputable sources, but it's the internet, so who knows?
Yeah, who knows? People don't always tell the truth on the internet.
Anyway, well.
Starkers.
Yeah. So that was our Good Omens episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Reach out to us if you want to. We can receive emails now.
Yay! Please rate and review us on iTunes.
It helps a lot. A rating, a review. We'd love it. We'd appreciate it.
Keep calm and don't think of it as dying. Think of it as leaving before the rush.